At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Here's the thing about the post office, politics aside, okay? Making stamps even a lot more expensive is not gonna cure its ills. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, today, 17 August. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. If you had the United States Postal Service as a partisan political proxy on your 2020 election bingo card, you win, I guess. The politics of it, we will assume you are mostly familiar with. Speaker Nancy Pelosi is calling the House back into session, legislation likely. Postmaster General and CEO Louis DeJoy has said he will testify. But as all of that plays out, a detour here, if we might, to the Postal Service's business model reality. Yes, the digital age has brought its challenges to the USPS, but as Congress tries to figure out how to repair the damage, it might do well to look in the mirror for a little bit. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
The Postal Service is supposed to be self-funded, not getting any government money. But the post office is still tightly regulated by Congress. And in 2006, Congress passed a law requiring the Postal Service to prepay health benefits for its retirees. Jim Campbell is a lawyer and consultant on the Postal Service.
Congress ordered the Postal Service to pay for 10 years, about $5.5 billion a year into this prepayment fund.
The thinking was pay it forward, make sure the money is there when retirees need it. But Campbell says federal agencies don't have to make these prepayments, and the post office couldn't do it. Campbell says it missed more than half of the payments. To make matters worse, Congress capped postal office price increases for letters and circulars at the rate of inflation.
So the Postal Service is kind of caught in this squeeze.
Cornell University public policy professor Rick Geddes says Congress also still requires the post office to deliver to every mailbox in the country 6 days a week.
So this is a recipe for fiscal problems, serious fiscal problems.
And serious debt. Frank Todisco has been tracking that. He's chief actuary at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. He says the Postal Service is more than $160 billion in debt. Over the past decade, the debt and unfunded liabilities like pensions and health care have outpaced the revenues the Postal Service takes in.
So it's doubled from a little more than one times annual revenue to over double annual revenue.
Todisco says the Postal Service has been losing money for a decade, not a sustainable business model. But the post office can't change that model without congressional approval. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
If you're a homeowner who's been eyeing those below 3% mortgage rates and you're thinking to yourself, you know, Kai, now might be the time to refinance, well, hang on a minute, because unless you've already locked in your rate, chances are good you're going to get hit with something called an adverse market fee that's going to be charged on refis backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which is most of them. Marketplace's Amy Scott has the refi lay of the land.
Steph Noble is a loan officer with Guild Mortgage in Portland, Oregon. She's been fielding calls from disappointed customers looking to refinance.
Feeling just surprised and upset. In some cases, having the refinance not make sense for them any longer.
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac don't lend directly to consumers. They buy loans from lenders, bundle them into securities, and guarantee that investors in those securities get paid, even if borrowers default. Edward Pinto with the American Enterprise Institute says the new fee is aimed at protecting the companies from a higher risk of default.
Because those refinances during periods of market turmoil, which we're in terms of housing prices, can be very risky.
But there may be another reason for the fee. Fannie and Freddie have been under government protection and control since the last recession. Jim Parrott, a fellow with the Urban Institute, says the Trump administration is anxious to cut them loose.
My sense is that's their primary motivation, even if lurking behind it is this concern that they're going to see credit losses. Either way, it's about maintaining or building capital so that they can get them out sooner rather than later.
But he says that undercuts the Fed's efforts to stimulate the economy by keeping interest rates low. Nikitra Bailey is executive vice president with the Center for Responsible Lending.
What should happen as this economy is weakening is that Fannie and Freddie should make it easier for families to refinance and take advantage of historically low interest rates.
If lenders pass on the fee to borrowers, which she expects them to do, it could add on average $1,400 to the upfront cost of refinancing. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday in mid-August, a little bit of a split decision. Actually, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, true story. I was in L.A. interviewing for a job at Marketplace a while ago, anyway, and I was standing in a Barnes & Noble in Santa Monica, and the power went out. All of it. Cash registers, lights, the whole deal. A then-new phenomenon known as rolling blackouts, and it seems we have come full circle, because for the first time in almost 20 years, an intense statewide heat wave has transformers out here frying and the state's electrical grid operator doing those blackouts to prevent even more overload. Millions have been left in the dark for short periods over the last couple of days. But the question has to be, why all these years on is California still not able to handle spiking demands of a summer heat wave? Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one.
Tori Amoscato was practicing scales on her electric piano in her Los Angeles apartment when all of a sudden the sound just stopped.
Power went out around 4 o'clock on Saturday, and it didn't come on for another 20 hours.
She assumed it was a scheduled blackout in her neighborhood, but her outage was due to a busted transformer.
We call these heat storms for a reason.
Jeff Smith is a spokesperson for PG&E, one of the main providers of electricity in California. He says when temperatures don't drop at night as much as they normally do, power lines can be taxed to a breaking point. But most of the 250,000 customers who didn't have power this weekend were without it because the California Independent System Operator, CAISO, told PG&E and other electricity providers to shut off power to decrease load. Leah Stokes at the University of California, Santa Barbara, thinks that the grid operator might have been too conservative.
The amount of extra power that we had on the grid was really big and very manageable. So I think that it seems like the grid operator jumped the gun in terms of being a little paranoid.
Governor Gavin Newsom has called for an investigation, saying regulators didn't provide enough notice and failed Californians in not providing reliable power. CAISO declined an interview request, but Michael Wara at Stanford says CAISO was paranoid for a reason. If the grid operator had not been conservative, the consequences for the Western United States could have been catastrophic.
If California were to have a true crisis, an unplanned system outage, that would not stay in California.
Power outages would spread to states like Nevada, Arizona, and Oregon. Those states bordering California are closely connected in the Western grid. Wara says the real problem right now in California isn't a lack of energy supply. It's an old, inefficient grid. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A college degree is an investment that pays off for a lot of students. Most students, to be honest with you. But for most black college students, that payoff comes not without some risk. A year after graduating, black people are twice as likely to be unemployed as their white peers. And that makes, alongside all the other various structural economic disadvantages that black people have, like housing policies and hiring discrimination, for instance, it makes student debt another burden. We've been talking about ways to make this economy work better for everybody in it on the program, and today it is student loans. Ashley Harrington is senior counsel at the Center for Responsible Lending. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much.
Could you do me a favor and just to sort of level set here, put student debt and student loans into the context of the racial wealth gap in this economy?
Well, as I'm sure you know, we have now topped $1.7 trillion for almost 45 million Americans who are struggling with student debt. But the crisis is really being felt, the brunt of it, by Black Americans. Black borrowers are more likely to borrow more, and to struggle in repayment. And, you know, most folks, when they get ready to go to college or send their kids to college, they're relying on home ownership, stocks, all the things that make up wealth and security, which unfortunately, as we know, Black families have about a tenth of the wealth of white families. Meanwhile, you have to go to college these days because all of the jobs are requiring post-secondary credentials.
Let's talk actually a little bit more about the back end. Does a college education and accumulating all that debt, does it pay off for Black Americans the same way it pays off economically for white Americans?
It absolutely doesn't pay off the same way, but it's still necessary.
Yeah.
You need that credential in order to move along in the workforce and to hopefully move up in income. But when you look at the income gap, most Black folks have to get a secondary degree and even an advanced degree if they want the same income that white folks get with just a bachelor's degree. And that is directly the result of the fact that Black families have not been able to build the wealth that white families have over the course of centuries and decades.
Is there a way that Black borrowers in higher education specifically, but writ large in your, you know, larger corporate hat here, is there a way they can be supported that will get them to where we all need to be?
Absolutely. The first thing that we have to start with is there has to be some level of cancellation. CRL just last year did a report where we found that even at $10,000 of across-the-board universal cancellation, you would have a profound impact on the borrowers who are struggling the most. So now that we're in this even worse economic situation, we're calling for $20,000 at least of universal debt cancellation. And again, that would have a disproportionate impact on borrowers of color. But then we also talk about ways to fix the student loan repayment system itself. I don't know if you know this, Kai, but there are right now 5+ income-based repayment plans, a number of other plans. It's a nightmare to navigate for both borrowers and servicers. There should be one income-based repayment plan that is open to all borrowers, including Parent Plus borrowers. And one other piece about it that's really important is it should be a 15-year repayment term.
Do me a favor, would you, and take off your analytical problem-solving hat here for a second and answer
okay.
this contextual.
You just asked me to put it on.
Well, no, look, I mean, right? I asked the question and you gave me the answer. And look, this is your, and this goes to the question, right? Because this is where you've spent your career, right? You've been at Center for Responsible Lending. You've been at United Negro College Fund. You've worked on these issues. And what I want to know is when did you realize that racism in education and how we pay for it is systemic?
Wow. I mean, I think it's since I've been at Center for Responsible Lending, and then that my time at UNCF was also helpful. I think you have to think about it in context. So we had the Higher Education Act in 1965. When that was enacted, the Pell Grant itself covered over 70% of the cost of 1 year of college at a public institution. Now it covers less than 30%. That's one. Two, after the Great Recession, when state governments were tightening their belts, the first place they looked to cut their budgets was in higher education, meaning that as more Black people were going to college, they were also facing more of the burden than ever before of paying for college.
Do you think it's fixable?
I think it's fixable with a commitment, targeted investment, and a recognition that this is something that was created by federal policies. It's a federal system, and therefore it can be fixed by federal policies. There's many things that have to be done to close the racial wealth gap beyond just fixing our broken higher education and student loan repayment system. But this is definitely a part of that.
Ashley Harrington at the Center for Responsible Lending. Thank you so much for your time and your insights. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Have a good one.
As Ashley pointed out, there are a whole lot of things we have to do to close the racial wealth gap in this economy. We did an hour-long special about some of those ideas. It's airing on some local public radio stations, and you can hear it online, of course, at marketplace.org. Check out the Economy Now What page. Coming up.
It really changes my ability to interact with students.
Technology does not always make things easier, you know, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's down 86 points today, about 0.3%, 27,844. The NASDAQ, on the other hand, rose 110 points, 1%, 11,129. The S&P 500 added 9 points, about 0.2%, 33.81 today. Builder confidence in newly built single-family homes jumped 6 points to a record tying 78 on the National Association of Home Builders Wells Fargo Housing Market Index. Try saying that 10 times fast. Here's why we mention it. Anything above 50 is considered a positive sentiment. Low mortgage rates motivating buyers, but builders do worry that rising lumber prices are going to ruin the mood. Since April, Home Depot has seen a 35% jump in foot traffic. Thus, Home Depot and Lowe's both reported financial results this week for the period May through July. Going to be nice numbers, one imagines. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hey everyone, it's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. This pandemic has, of course, changed a whole lot about how most of us work, either from home or in a job that's essential and obliges you to be out and about. The other thing it has changed, though, is how much we don't work. People working from home are putting in longer hours as the boundary between personal and professional breaks down, and layoffs and furloughs have left a lot of people with less security and more responsibilities. And now, with the waning days of summer vacation upon us, we find people have been taking less paid time off. From the Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has that one.
Nicole Wong had been dreaming about taking a break from her job as a training manager for business service firm PwC to relive the good times she's had with her family in Hawaii.
Some of our favorite memories from the 3 Hawaiian vacations we've taken over the years were snorkeling and seeing sea turtles while we're doing it.
Adventures she captured on her phone.
Sea turtle. Oh, it just came out for air, Peter. You saw it?
Going to free hula lessons at the shopping mall or at your hotel.
Her family had booked another Hawaii trip for the end of May, but the pandemic scrambled those plans. So she recreated the experience in the backyard of her Silicon Valley home.
We packed our suitcases and took them through the airport of our house in a cardboard box to Hawaii, which was the backyard. And then we stayed in our hotel in Hawaii, which was a tent overlooking our one palm tree.
She planned an entire week of Hawaii-themed activities, making spam musubi, snorkeling in the hot tub. But for many workers, the idea of burning paid time off right now just doesn't feel right. A survey by staffing firm Robert Half International found more than a third of workers planned to save their vacation for later in the year, and more than a quarter planned to take less time off overall.
It feels weird taking it without having a real good reason to take it. Just spend it lounging around the house, yeah.
Data scientist James Hendricks has been cooped up in his Houston home with his family for months. They've already canceled a trip to Disney World later in the year, and he doesn't even feel comfortable taking short day trips out of town.
Having to stop for gas and having kids in the car that will need to go to the bathroom at some point, I just don't want to manage all of that.
Atlanta commercial photographer Kyle Pierce has also been stalling on taking time off. He works in retail and his wife works for an airline, so job security is a little iffy. Plus, he really wants to save his days off to visit his parents in North Carolina whenever that becomes safe.
We're big family people, so my parents being in their 80s, you know, normally we would go back there to see them.
But he's not sure that will happen this year.
What happens when I still have 3 weeks come December and I can only carry a week over?
The specter of employees banking large amounts of paid time off has become a concern for many employers, says Alyssa Jessup with the Society for Human Resource Management.
It could cause an employee to either lose their vacation time that they earned, or if a large group of employees are requesting time off near the end of the year so they don't lose it, could also impact business operations as well.
In some cases, companies must pay employees for unused PTO. And then there's the issue of burnout.
Without proper breaks, our employees just aren't as productive as they need to be, right?
Jill Chapman with HR services firm Insperity says the added stressors of the pandemic make it even more important for workers to take a break.
There's probably a lot of us that haven't really come to grips with maybe what the pandemic has done to us. We just keep shoving things back and shoving things back. And, you know, there's going to be a point where we maybe hit a wall.
She says managers can model that it's okay by taking time off themselves. Some companies like Microsoft have given employees extra vacation days, while others have switched to unlimited PTO. There's little risk employees will abuse the policy, says Chapman. Even during normal times, Americans leave up to half their vacation days unused. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
School this year, K through 12 and college, is going to be nobody's idea of a good time. Let's just stipulate that. Zoom and all the other remote technologies just aren't up to what they are being used for. Now, consider students with disabilities. As unwieldy as all that tech is for others, it is so much worse for them. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has the story.
A Zoom meeting can look very different if you're using a sign language.
You see how the light keeps kind of flashing and changing as I move.
That's Gallaudet University linguistics professor Julie Hoxing speaking American Sign Language through an interpreter. Her laptop's camera adjusts focus as she moves her hands closer or further away, making it seem lights are flickering in her living room.
So my students have to watch an hour of this flickering of light behind me. You know, maybe a minute or two is fine, but the constant flickering becomes quite exhausting on the mind and eyes.
So she bought an external camera for this new semester that should take care of the flickering. But then there's the video chat software itself. Zoom and others focus on the person speaking out loud, so someone asking a question in ASL wouldn't get highlighted. And putting everyone in a grid creates tiny boxes where it's hard to see people's hands.
I wish that Zoom would let us set up who we can have on screen. It really changes my ability to interact with students.
Zoom says it will have new features to help with classroom management later this month based on, quote, feedback from the education community. And even for tech that can be made accessible, there's the cost. Cindy Wiley is the digital accessibility lead at Iowa State University. They say virtual lectures need to be captioned, but since automatic transcription tools aren't accurate enough to meet federal standards, schools have to pay for human captioners.
To achieve 99% accuracy with a live human editor in a class, it's going to be around $1 a minute.
Some professors also need to put special HTML language in their materials so it can work with screen readers, which can cost thousands of dollars per class.
Remediation is always going to be more expensive than it is to have an established process in line from the very beginning.
Some K through 12 districts buy learning management programs where teachers can post worksheets and videos and students can upload homework. But some programs don't allow kids to print out those materials. Liz Kolb is a learning technologies professor at the University of Michigan.
Students that physically need to be able to write and can't do it through their screen very easily are not going to be able to engage in doing a traditional worksheet. And that is problematic.
Kolb mentioned Seesaw, a popular program for elementary schools, which didn't allow printing. She also said it isn't compatible with screen readers for students with low vision. Seesaw did add the ability to print last week, according to Chief Product Officer Carl Sjogren. And he said Seesaw's buttons and instructions do support screen readers, but the app doesn't allow teachers to include alt text descriptions for the pictures they upload.
So right now, we don't support that kind of thing, but I think it's the kind of thing that we're looking at as we try and figure out how to get better at this. It's definitely not something that I think we consider a solved problem, nor do I think has anyone else in the sort of education technology realm solved with this kind of more visual, elementary-aged learning content.
Kolb at the University of Michigan says even the most accessible tools may not be as effective as in-person instruction for some students.
It's still not the same as having a teacher or a support person sitting next to you and working through things together with you or helping you turn the pages of a book.
And with millions learning online this fall, that could leave those students behind throughout the pandemic. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, which is either the wave of the future or today's entry in the what can possibly go wrong file. The United States Postal Service, whence we began today, has filed a patent, it turns out, for a vote by blockchain technology. Here is the verbiage from the patent application. A registered voter receives a computer-readable code in the mail and confirms identity and confirms correct ballot information in an election. The system separates voter identification and votes to ensure vote anonymity and stores votes on a distributed ledger in a blockchain. End of quote. I mean, yes, it's probably coming, but Holy cow, look at the time. We got a boogie. Our daily production team includes Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
Hey, everyone. It's Rima Khreis, host of This Is Uncomfortable. If you're looking for some good recommendations on books to read, well, you should join This Is Uncomfortable's Summer Book Club. Every other week in our newsletter, we'll share a new book that'll make you rethink your relationship to money, class, and work, while also featuring an interview with the author or an expert on the topic. Plus, when you join, you'll be entered in a giveaway where you could win some This Is Uncomfortable merch. Be sure to check it out. Sign up today at marketplace.org/bookclub.